Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Tom DelBanco of Harvard, founder of Open Notes, a movement he started to make clinicians' notes available for patients to view in their electronic medical record. He launched the effort a decade ago with much pushback from the medical establishment, but they've just passed the 40 million patient threshold. He talks about how it enhances patient engagement and improves patient satisfaction. Lori Robertson also checks in. Managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Tom DelBanco of Open Notes here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Tom DelBanco, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and co-founder of Open Notes, an international movement to give patients access to clinical notes in their electronic health record. Dr. DelBanco was chief of the Division of General Medicine and Primary Care at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, and also created the Harvard Medical School Faculty Development and Fellowship Program. Dr. DelBanco earned his medical degree from Columbia University, and we welcome you to Conversations on Healthcare.
Terrific to be talking with you.
You know, I've heard you say that your main mission in life has been to draw closer to those that we serve, and it's no surprise that you launched Open Notes a decade ago in an effort to empower patients to give them access to their provider's clinical notes and their electronic health record. And we celebrate with you. It sounded like you had a milestone recently. Over 40 million patients have now engaged in Open Notes through their electronic health record. And I'm wondering if you could just share with our listeners the origins of Open Notes movement with us and how this once radical idea has now taken root as part of the mainstream.
Well, in 1973, I woke up one morning to read an article in the New England Journal of Medicine written by a social scientist and a pediatrician saying we should really share our records, our notes, and everything we do with our patients. And a light bulb went off for me. And that light bulb was actually supported further by an experience I had with a new patient a few years later. I'm a primary care doctor. For 40 years, I took care of a panel of patients. And I got a new patient one day who was sent to me actually by his family because his blood pressure was hard to control. And when I took a history from him, as you do, I got out my problem list and began dutifully noting down on the problem list. And I learned from him that he was having a little trouble at work, was having trouble with his blood pressure, was having trouble with his spouse, wasn't enjoying life very much, smoked, had a couple of beers a day, sex wasn't working so well. And I sat there and I put this together. And then I realized he was also a printer by profession. And printers in those days could read everything upside down as a result of that. So I said to him, Mr. A, I assume you can read everything that I'm writing. And he said, yeah, that's true, doctor. And I said, I'm in a bit of a quandary. I think listening to your history that you drink more than two beers a day and that you're probably in the early stages of alcohol abuse. But I don't know whether I should write that down or not because there's no point in my writing it down if you don't agree with me, really. And he fell silent for about 30 seconds. And he said, doc, you better write it down. And that proved actually to be a turning point in his history, and he was able to stop drinking too much, and life got a lot better for him, and that was another light bulb for me. Then what happened, of course, is we got computerized medical records. We got them very early at our hospital in Boston, homegrown. To this day, it's homegrown. And that was the end of the world for the doctors, but then they got used to it. And then in the late 90s, we did one of the earliest patient portals in which we offered patients access through secure internet processes to reading about their lab tests, to looking at their problem list, to looking at their medication list, and to sending, in some cases, secure emails to their providers. And that was the end of the world for the doctors, but then it proved not to be the end of the world. And then Jan Walker and I, Jan and I have worked together for 30 years. Jan is a nurse by training, but a health services researcher. We kind of said the next step is, why don't we invite patients to read everything we do, including what we write about them? We went to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. They were kind enough to give us a planning grant and then more grants. And we've had an extraordinarily exciting adventure in the past 10 years as a result of that kind of strange but quite traditional course of innovation in healthcare. Right. Usually comes from one patient, usually comes from one insight or one thought by one person. And then it blossoms into something that hopefully can be exciting. Usually it isn't, but this has been one of the lucky breaks for me and a very exciting adventure.
Well, I'll say that from what I understand, the patient's response to you, your printer patient who was able to read his notes upside down and really responded with openness and truthfulness in a way that could allow you to help him, was maybe a little bit of a different reaction than what I've understood you had when you floated the idea of open notes to the provider community, and you used the expression that the world is ending. There was a real concern that it might add unwanted burden to the workflow of the providers, and even more than that, there was this sense that patients maybe couldn't be trusted with all that information, or that information might somehow be upsetting or worrying to them more so than they already were. But you've done the research, which we really appreciate, to show that patients have responded favorably. It has benefited them. But the clinicians also report that there's benefits, maybe unexpected benefits that have come with this. So maybe share with our listeners a little more about what you've learned from the research that you've done.
Well, we wrote a paper in the Annals of Internal Medicine, I think in 2010. 9 years ago, in which we just suggested the idea once again that with the use of electronic records, now patients should be invited to read notes. And the editor of the Annals got an almost scatological letter from one of the regents of the American College of Physicians, which publishes the Annals, saying, this is the craziest idea I've ever heard of. Doesn't Dr. Dobanko and his colleagues understand that records belong to doctors? They're the domain of the doctors. Doctors use them to remind themselves of patients, to communicate with other colleagues. There are already too many people looking at records, such as insurance people and quality people and sometimes lawyers. And where does he get off saying that now patients and their families should also be part of that? And I ended up actually debating him at an annual meeting of the American College of Physicians. So there was real resistance. And one of the big institutions that has yet to adopt open notes, one of the trustees who is a physician, is said to have gotten up and said, you're going to do this over my dead body.
The proverbial dead body story.
So we went ahead and did this pilot study with 20,000 patients and 100 primary care doctors who volunteered in Boston at our hospital, which is an urban hospital with associated suburban practices, at the Geisinger Health Center in Pennsylvania, which is decidedly rural, less educated people, a quarter of them had not gotten out of high school. And then we did it with a safety net hospital in Washington State, the Harborview Medical Center at the University of Washington. And we just did it for a year, and we asked doctors and patients at the end of that year, what was it like? And the patients absolutely loved it. I mean, I've never seen a study in my life where 99% of anyone says anything about something. 99% of the patients thought it was the right thing to do and liked it. And we got very exciting, clinically important reports from them. They felt more in control of their health care. They remembered what happened in visits better. Remember that when you go to see the doctor, you remember about 50% of what he or she said. And of that, you remember about half of it wrong. That's been shown in many studies. It's a terribly stressful time. It's the worst time in the world to educate anyone about anything. You should educate before or after a visit. They were able to go home and cogitate, think about what was going on, digest it, look things up, and they felt terrific about it. They also wanted to share it with other people in their home. And 80% in our very first study said, this is something that I really want to have, that everyone should have, that would determine my choice of the next health professional I go to. And there was very little downside. Now, the doctors, on the other hand, were worried about two things primarily. One was that it would interfere with workflow. Doctors 9 years ago were stressed. Doctors today are even more stressed. doctors are a dispirited bunch much too often. Certainly primary care doctors are, and this was a study of primary care. And even though these doctors only were volunteering and knew they could stop after a year, they were very worried that it would interfere with the way things went. And they were also very worried that they would scare their patients. Well, it turned out that their workflow was not perturbed. The email traffic did not change. We counted that. The biggest, most common question I was actually asked by the doctors in that trial was, are you sure the computer's working? They virtually noticed nothing while the patients were having a wonderful time with us. And the patients were also reporting that very few of them were worried or confused or agitated by the notes that they wrote. Far fewer than the doctors had predicted. So that was a very good sign. And that really, we published that now in 2012, 7 years ago, results of about 5,000 patients who completed surveys after this study. And now we are, as you mentioned, at a point where 40 million Americans have electronic access to notes through patient portals on which they've registered. It doesn't mean they're all reading the notes, by the way, but they have access.
I want to pick up on that theme that you have so many patients who are reading those notes and sharing them with their loved ones and their family. But you also have some fairly significant health systems that are using these. You mentioned Geisinger, Mayo Clinic, Kaiser's involved, the VA as well. And I'm wondering, as you sort of look at what is sort of straightforward and simple, how has it impacted the clinical practice and outcomes as well?
So we have very few studies yet, and we may never have studies that show differences in clinical outcomes. That's a very complicated discussion. What we do have is much, much more data replicated from many centers now. We have 200 centers, more than 200 centers involved with Open Notes. Extraordinarily similar reports from patients and doctors about their experiences with Open Notes. We did do one study in which we were able to compare patients with Open Notes to patients without Open Notes in the way that they refilled their medicines if they had high blood pressure. And we were gratified to see that those who read their notes, or those who actually had access to their notes, we don't know whether they read them or not, had higher refill rates of their medicines than those who did not have access. That's the only really formal outcome study that we have so far. On the other hand, we have institutions trying a little pilots and saying, we're going to do this. It's the right thing to do. And it's useful for our patients, and it's useful for us. We have many, many anecdotes about patient safety. Two eyes on one chart are better than two eyes on 1,000 charts. And when you've got a patient reviewing his or her record and saying, there's a mistake here, it's the left knee, not the right knee. I missed that lump, or the doctor missed that lump. I was supposed to follow through on it. We have many rather exciting and sobering anecdotes now in the patient safety arena, which says this really increases safety. We think it's a very important part of it. We also, with medications and adherence to medications, we just published a paper in the last few weeks in the Annals of Internal Medicine showing that patients say very firmly that they're understanding their medicines better, they're seeing what their medicines are for better, and that is 15 to maybe 40% of patients say they're taking their medicines more effectively. It costs our nation $300 billion a year to have poor adherence to medications. And if you do a little bit of math and you extrapolate to more patients reading their notes, reading about their medicines, that to me as a doctor is maybe the most exciting finding we have so far.
So much of your work, as I've read about it, has really been about creating a healthcare system that is really designed through the patient's eyes. I remember years ago with young clinicians and back when we were still in paper charts, really needing to remind people to write their notes as if the patient was going to read those notes. But I picked up on a comment that you made in one of your articles. You said that most clinicians believe that they are the ones who are saving patients, but that you believe it's actually the patients who can save the clinicians. Maybe expound on that a little bit, how that's really at the core of what you see as a truly patient-centric healthcare system.
In a way, it's a little tangential to Open Notes, but doctors and nurses, but doctors in particular, are having a very hard time right now. And they've lost a lot of their persuasive authority, their influence in the world. they feel that way. They feel kind of disempowered. They feel that they're run by corporations now, controlled by corporations. It's not what they went to medical school for. And as you probably know, there's a very high burnout rate among doctors. We're finding that in our own studies. And they're a dispirited lot. And that's particularly true in primary care. The people they feel closest to are their patients. And the mechanisms that I believed in, I think, will bring them closer still to their patients. We can discuss about even co-generation of a medical record. Patients are our citizenry. You know, they're the consumers of the world. They're 340 million American patients. They're not nearly as many doctors. I think it's when the citizenry wakes up and stands up and says, you have to change the circumstances for us as patients and for those who are caring for us as doctors, that meaningful positive change will occur. So that's the sense I've said that patients will rescue us. If they care about us, if we think we care about them, which I think for the most part we really do, that's why we went into the healing professions, I think they will be our salvation rather than we being their salvation. Basically, we're talking about a partnership, right? And that's everything that I've been working on, is partnerships between patients, families, and those who care for them. And I think it will inure to the benefit of all involved. I'm a little bit of an optimist. I'm a little bit of an idealist, but that's where that came from, that kind of comment.
Well, that's great. And we're speaking today with Dr. Tom DelVanco, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and co-founder of Open Notes International Movement to give patients access to clinical notes in their electronic health record. And Tom, I want to sort of pull the thread on someone who is seasoned, I would say, in the health system, about how you're reimagining the future of the health system. And we had the opportunity of having one of your colleagues on, Dr. John Halemka, demonstrating his work in sort of voice-activated interfaces with Alexa. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your vision of that next phase around empowerment and the role technology will play as we look out in the horizon.
Well, if patients don't get more engaged in their own healthcare actively and quickly, we're going to be in even more soup than we are in now. Mm-hmm. The engaged patient, there's lots of data now. The engaged patient has better outcomes, does better, and is probably adds to the value of healthcare, costs the system less money, and improves the quality. So any strategy that is directed toward engaging patients actively in his or her care is very important to do. More specifically, with respect to records, while my friend at the American College of Physicians said that doctors own records, I think that is changing, and that I would say that right now, patients and doctors probably jointly own records, and my vision for the future is that patients will own the records. That's true, interestingly, in many countries that we call developing countries. In some societies, the patient walks between doctors carrying a notebook. The doctor writes in that notebook, or the practitioner, or whoever he sees, and then the patient takes that and walks to the next town, or the next city, or the next disaster, or the next thing happened, and he or she is the keeper of his or her healthcare record. Because of apps, because of electronics, because of the need for interoperability, the need for one institution to be able to talk to patients and another one and to have patients have it all together, that's inexorably what's going to happen. I don't know if Apple will pull it off first or Facebook or Amazon or one of the big boys or one of the smaller people. That's what's going to happen. You're going to soon have on your cell phone or on your watch or on your whatever, you're going to have all your records together. And in fact, you're going to be able to manipulate them, control them, understand them, integrate them. That's certainly the vision that I have. John and I are close friends. So, and that involves engagement and control. Now, you may just drop it down and say, I'm not interested. Doctor, tell me what to do. And that's fine. I learned early on, it's totally impossible to predict what the model is between a patient and a doctor unless you ask them. I would ask my patients, do you want me to be stern and distant? You want me to be warm and cuddly? Are you a first name person? I could never predict the response, but I would write it down and then I would try and assume that role with what patients are comfortable with. Some patients are going to want to master all their record. Some will want to go nowhere near it because it'll terrify them. But we have to begin, I think, in pre-kindergarten. I asked my 6-year-old grandson a few years ago, "Do you want to read your notes?" And his response was perfect. He says, "If Mom says it's okay, I'd like to read them." Young people will evolve that way. Young people are much more used to transparency. We're talking about transparency, basically, aren't we? We're talking about really open communication. We have to develop a healthcare system that can do that. It will save us money, I think. It will improve longevity, which is a problem, because as people live longer, they cost more money. But I'm not an economist, and I'm glad I'm not. Someone once taught me that if everyone stopped smoking right away, that would bankrupt our healthcare system because people live so long. And it's no joke. It's a difficult issue.
And I just want to make sure we get in a question. We talked about the kindergartners, but I'd really love for you to opine on how well we're doing with the generation that's coming up of healthcare providers. When you look back on your wonderful long history in healthcare and in education and in medical education, give us a sense of what you see as the big transformation, the way we educate and train that next generation of physicians and other healthcare providers to be this patient-centered person that engages the patient, shares with the patient. Has healthcare education really changed to embrace this model?
So I'm going to give you a counterintuitive answer, which is going to make you nervous. I think we've become infinitely better over the years, and I do have a long trajectory to look at teaching young health professionals what it is to be with a person, how it is to ask questions, how it is to listen, how it is to develop more empathy, how it is to think about the whole person. I think we're infinitely better at that than my teachers helped me be when I was a young doctor. The paradox is I think that these people know much less medicine than I did. There's only a certain amount of time in a day, and I was busily learning different heart murmurs and different heart sounds and what it was to examine the abdomen, and I think I'm much better at that than the young doctors of today. So what's the trade-off between them? There's no question that young people today, of course, are much more technologically savvy. I go to my grandchildren for help with my computers. There's no question that I think they're more used to transparency. Transparency is, by the way, also a two-edged sword. It's not all good. There's some difficult parts about it. I think we need to mobilize patients as teachers. That's something we haven't done well yet and that we should do much more. They can be our best teachers. I had many patients who I would put in rooms with my medical students, and I wanted to give them a Harvard appointment because they were far better teachers to my students than I was, I thought, in many respects. And I think we have to do that in a more organized way. I'm very bullish about young people. Yeah. They will be much better at things in the end than I am. And that you are and that we were. It'll be an exciting evolution to watch. I hope I'm around to watch some of it.
Exactly.
It will involve technology for sure. But it's not easy, and we've had many fits and starts. And for every time we go up, we take a few steps backwards. Yeah. And how it will come out is not so easy to say.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Tom DelBanco, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and co-founder of Open Notes, an international movement to give patients access to clinical notes in their electronic health record. You can learn more about his important work by going to opennotes.org, or you can follow them on Twitter at myopennotes. Dr. DelBanco, thank you so much for your decades of dedication and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
On the campaign trail, former Vice President Joe Biden and President Donald Trump have both claimed that a cure to cancer would soon become a reality if they were elected in 2020. Experts, however, don't share that degree of optimism. Despite considerable progress, especially in recent years, cancer isn't one disease to cure, and advances in all the many types of cancer are likely to take multiple decades. In a speech in Iowa on June 11th, Biden said, quote, "I promise you, if I'm elected president, you're going to see the single most important thing that changes America. We're going to cure cancer." A week later, on June 18, Trump made a similar statement during his 2020 kickoff rally as he listed several agenda items for a second term. He said, quote, "We will come up with the cures to many, many problems, to many, many diseases, including cancer and others." While both politicians suggested these cures would come while they were still in office, neither explicitly said when exactly this would happen. But oncologists say curing cancer is unlikely to happen within the next decade. The first problem with both politicians' statements, several experts told us, is that cancer isn't a single disease. Timothy Chan, a physician scientist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, told us the name cancer applies to hundreds or thousands of types of diseases. Given that curing cancer would mean finding many cures, Chan said doing so would be, quote, impossible in the next 10 years, quote, maybe the next 50 years to cover everything, he said. Even if all cancers can't be cured soon, multiple experts were quick to point out that some cancers can already be cured, no advances needed. And researchers are encouraged about many newly developed treatments, such as immunotherapies that take advantage of the body's immune system to attack cancer. Regardless of who wins the White House in 2020, experts told us the way to speed up progress on cancer is to pay for more research. Without funding, breakthroughs can't happen. For more on this topic, see our website at factcheck.org. I'm Lori Robertson, Fact Check's managing editor.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. For all the people in the world without limbs, acquiring prosthetics can be costly and out of reach. It's especially challenging to make prosthetics for children, since they are in constant state of growth. Rochester Institute of Technology scientist Dr. John Shul stumbled upon a clever and affordable solution, provided online open source templates to anyone anywhere in the world who has access to a 3D printer, and provide prosthetic hands for next to nothing.
I've made this Google Maps mashup. If you have a 3D printer and you'd like to help, put yourself on this map. And if you know someone who needs a hand, put yourself on this map. And by God, something like this got going.
So he founded the Enable Network, which has massed thousands of volunteer makers in upwards of 40 countries around the world, providing cheap but functional prosthetics for children in need.
I think we're currently pushing 5,800 identified members in our Google Plus community, and we have followings in the thousands more. We know that we've delivered about 800 hands devices, and we suspect that a comparable number have been downloaded by people we can't track because we put all of our design on the internet.
The movement has grown so rapidly, the simple limb designs have become more sophisticated as recipients of the prosthetic devices provide feedback for designers to make more efficient devices.
We're still working on opposable thumbs. We're still working on individual finger movements. These things grip or ungrip. That's all they do. So they're much less functional than a biological hand, and they're also less functional than a fancy myoelectric hand. But for kids, it's huge because those expensive devices are typically out of reach for children who would outgrow them. So it doesn't make sense for them to get a $5,000 or $10,000 hand. And, you know, our hands don't even pretend to look like regular hands. They look like superhero Iron Man hands. And for that very reason, they're very popular with kids.
Enable, a global collaborative network of open source designs, linking to makers with 3D printers to provide low-cost prosthetic limbs to children and adults around the world who might otherwise not be able to afford them. Now that's a bright idea. You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.